It's the NPR News Update for Monday, May 13th, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Matt Sepik in for Phil Picardi. In the news today, the Minnesota Senate gets ready to vote this afternoon on a bill to legalize same-sex marriage in the state. Governor Dayton and DFL legislative leaders reach a budget deal that'll likely mean higher taxes for top earners and a group of Somali men and women from the Twin Cities convicted of terrorism charges face sentencing this week in federal court. A bill to legalize same-sex marriage in Minnesota faces its final step in the legislative process today. The Senate is scheduled to take up the bill and is widely expected to pass it. Governor Mark Dayton says he'll sign the measure. The House passed the bill Thursday, largely along party lines, but with some Republican support. Here in St. Paul, Mayor Chris Coleman issued a proclamation temporarily renaming the Wabasha Street Freedom Bridge the Wabasha Street Freedom to Marry Bridge. The word freedom was added to the bridge's name to commemorate the first anniversary of the September 11th attacks. More on today's Senate vote is just ahead in the podcast. Also at the Capitol, Governor Mark Dayton and top Democrats in the legislature have reached a budget deal that would raise income taxes on top earners, erase a $627 million budget deficit, and boost funding for public schools. Additionally, the agreement raises the cigarette tax and pays back money owed to schools from earlier budget deals through a temporary income tax hike on top earners. The House version of the tax bill includes a 4% surcharge on incomes above $500,000 to pay back schools, but Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach says it won't be that high in the end.
We don't know exactly what the number is, but it's going to be a much smaller percentage than what you've heard. And the reason is, we are going to take the fund balance on June 30th in this current biennium that we're in and apply that to the school shift before we consider imposing any kind of a surcharge.
There will also be an expansion of the state sales tax to some yet-to-be-determined business-to-business transactions. The deal was announced Sunday, and Republican House Minority Leader Kurt Dowd of Crown described the plan as disappointing news from the DFL on Mother's Day.
Their gift for every hardworking mother in the state of Minnesota is going to be more than a $2 billion tax increase. We were hoping to hear that some of these plans were going to be reeled back and scaled back. Unfortunately, it looks like everything that we feared is still on the table.
Dowd says Republicans will not support the DFL's $800 million bonding bill, which would require some GOP votes to pass. In other news, a group of Somali men and women convicted of terrorism charges will be sentenced starting today in Minneapolis federal court. Brent Williams has more.
Among the group of nine people facing prison time is a man who recruited young Somali men from Minnesota to travel to the Horn of Africa to fight for the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Late last year, a jury found Mahmoud Saeed Omar guilty of 5 counts of terrorism-related felonies, including conspiracy to kill, kidnap, maim, and injure, which carries a potential life sentence. Two Rochester women convicted in 2011 of sending money to Al-Shabaab also face 30 years or more in prison. The convictions are part of what federal officials call Operation Rhino, a sweeping investigation of Al-Shabaab recruitment in the United States. Since 2007, about 24 young Twin Cities men are believed to have left for Somalia to join the group as fighters. Federal prosecutors say they found no evidence that the Al-Shabaab recruits were planning any attacks in the United States. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Today, members of the Minnesota Senate vote on the same-sex marriage bill the House approved last week. On both sides of the aisle and the issue, many lawmakers are taking positions that conflict with the way the majority of their constituents voted last fall on a state constitutional amendment that would have banned same-sex marriage had it passed. As Mark Sedeklik reports, that could spell re-election trouble.
Among the many members of the Minnesota legislature whose support or opposition to same-sex marriage appears to put them at odds with most voters in their district is Republican Senate Minority Leader David Hahn. Last fall, fewer than 4 in 10 voters in Hahn's Eden Prairie district cast ballots to ban same-sex marriage in the Constitution. Still, Hahn will vote no on the gay marriage bill.
I have always supported the law that we have on the books today, which defines marriage to be between one man and one woman.
Outside the Eden Prairie Library, several of Hahn's constituents say their wishes, not Hahn's personal beliefs, should drive his same-sex marriage vote. Eden Prairie resident Stacy Mackay says last fall's no vote on banning same-sex marriage amounted to a vote in favor of allowing gay marriage.
I think it's fair to say that.
Because a majority of Han's constituents voted no on the amendment, Mackay says Han should vote yes on allowing same-sex marriage.
The basis of a democracy and an educated community, such as we can definitely rely on in the state of Minnesota, they have to respect the fact that Minnesotans are pretty well-versed in the areas and they should be representing those people.
Fellow Eden Prairie resident David Reedy supports gay marriage and agrees with Mackay that Han should vote for it.
I think he should vote with the will of the people.
One of the House members from Han's area, Republican Jennifer Loon, voted for the same-sex marriage bill last week. For his part, Han says it's a mistake to equate the failure of the constitutional amendment with support for changing state law to allow gay marriage.
I talked to a lot of people who didn't support the amendment. Many of them said we didn't need to have the amendment because we had a law. And that's why we shouldn't vote for the marriage amendment.
Statewide, the amendment failed last year with about 51% voting no and 48% voting yes. In some legislative districts, there was more support and opposition than in the state as a whole. That means there will likely be political repercussions for lawmakers who vote against the will of their districts on marriage. Back outside the Eden Prairie Library, Ellen Olson alluded to the tough situation lawmakers like Han face.
Oh, dear. That's hard for him politically.
University of Minnesota political science professor Catherine Pearson says just because a lawmaker votes in opposition to the apparent majority position on same-sex marriage does not mean the lawmaker's political future is in jeopardy. Pearson says some may even attract new support for taking a principled stand despite the political risk.
So many times voters are frustrated because they see legislators who don't vote their conscience and are just follow the fray, or they potentially think follow the money. And in this case, if legislators are able to explain that they followed their conscience, gave a lot of thought to this issue, it could really go a long way, even in deeply divided districts.
Pearson says some of the biggest political problems might have nothing to do with general elections, but instead present themselves in the form of primary challengers to Republicans who vote in favor of same-sex marriage. But Pearson says given how quickly sentiment over gay marriage has been changing, it's hard to tell where voters and politicians will be on the issue even as soon as next year.
This is a quickly evolving issue, and not just among Democrats. It's obviously, Democrats have obviously come on board with same-sex marriage much more quickly than Republicans, but we are seeing a lot of Republicans, fewer at the elected level, but a lot of Republicans who are involved in GOP politics come out in support of same-sex marriage. And then if you look at the generational divides, the overwhelming majority of young people of both parties support same-sex marriage.
Just like last week when the same-sex marriage bill came to the House floor for debate, supporters and opponents are expected to flock to the Capitol today for the Senate debate and vote. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Eden Prairie.
Many gay couples here in Minnesota are trying to figure out how their lives will change with legal marriage as an option. Here's reporter Rupa Shenoy.
Lisa Vicoli says it takes her breath away when she thinks about how her life may change fundamentally in a way she never expected within the space of one day.
In some sense, all is forgiven at this point. So I'm so proud of us for being the first state in the Midwest to do this by legislative action and not by court action.
Vicoli is a curator of the U of M's GLBT archives. She and her partner, Margene Heft, met when Vicoli was in college 27 years ago and have been together ever since. Last year, while they were working together on the campaign to defeat the marriage amendment, Vicoli proposed. She fretted over details like whether to buy a ring and whether to get down on one knee.
I was surprised after all this time at how nervous I was. I thought that I would be I thought it wouldn't be a big deal, and I thought that, you know, I'm sure what the answer will be, and it'll be nice to do, but you know, it's not that big a deal. But I was really nervous about it.
They're planning to get married on August 1st, the first day same-sex marriages would be allowed in Minnesota.
We are very conscious of the fact that if we are going to do this, and if we are going to be able to include our parents, we have a very limited window.
Vicoli and her partner's parents are in their 90s. Her marriage will probably be one of many. The last census counted more than 10,000 same-sex couples in Minnesota. The Minnesota Management and Budget Office predicts that half of them will marry within a year of the bill being passed. And when they marry, many challenges same-sex couples are used to regularly facing may eventually disappear, like separate tax returns and insurance policies. Don Gelly says those challenges mean same-sex couples have had to work hard to be together, and they've gotten used to it. She and her partner have been together for 21 years.
In terms of navigating the legalities, it's been a long time of doing this. It hasn't always been easy. Been a big education.
Gelly says she and her partner pay thousands of dollars extra because they haven't been considered married. She says she'll have a lot of questions once the governor signs the bill.
Can we go back to our insurance and say, you know what, we should have insurance coverage just like any other married couple, and we should pay the premium for one policy instead of two?
Then there's employment benefits. Jody Graham says her partner, a Minneapolis cop, worries that if something happens to her, Graham won't be taken care of financially. As they consider what it means to be married in Minnesota, she says that's what comes to their minds first.
We kind of joke about how unromantic it is a little bit because we're focused so much on more of the legal aspect of it. I think it's definitely going to be a big weight off our shoulders.
Graham has lived her adult life without the possibility of getting married in Minnesota, but now she's got her hopes up.
We've been very optimistic. We are more worried about the House vote, and so I feel like now, you know, if for some reason something would happen in the Senate and it wouldn't happen, it'd be devastating.
But even if Minnesota legalizes same-sex marriage, Shannon Brumbaugh says same-sex couples won't really have equal rights until they can go anywhere in the country and be recognized as married. Brumbaugh and her partner of 22 years have a 21-year-old son.
I will celebrate. I will be in tears. I think it's absolutely wonderful and exciting. But I still think that the solution ultimately has to be for the whole nation to come together on this.
Brumbaugh says Minnesota's bill is a huge step in the right direction toward federal legalization of same-sex marriage. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News.
It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. A new study of Minnesota lakes finds more evidence that water across the state contains a wide range of chemicals. It's the largest study of its kind ever done in Minnesota, and it shows chemicals from household products, prescription, and illegal drugs are common in Minnesota lakes. There is evidence some of these chemicals are harmful to fish, but scientists are just starting to understand the environmental effects of products we use every day. Dan Gunderson reports.
Minnesota Pollution Control Agency scientists sampled 50 randomly chosen lakes across Minnesota last year. They tested the water for 125 chemicals. At least one chemical was found in 47 of the 50 lakes. One lake contained 13 different chemicals. The common insect repellent DEET was found in 76% of lakes. Bisphenol A, that's a chemical used in plastics, showed up in more than 40% of the lakes sampled. MPCA researcher Mark Ferre says some of the results are similar to what was found in earlier small studies.
It's confirming what we found in our other studies, but it also showed us some new things that we didn't see before and that are new to us.
The new findings include one of the most commonly prescribed antidepressants, amitriptyline, in nearly 30% of lakes. The veterinary antibiotic Carbadox was found in about 30% of lakes. Carbadox can only be used in hog production in the U.S. It's been banned in Canada and Europe because it can cause cancer. And the illegal drug cocaine showed up in about one-third of the lakes sampled. The MPCA didn't plan to test for cocaine, but it was included in a test that looked at a variety of chemicals. It's not unusual to find cocaine in water leaving sewage treatment plants, and European scientists found cocaine in air samples. Mark Ferre says government estimates put U.S. cocaine consumption at 156 tons a year. He says that's about the same volume as all commonly used pharmaceuticals combined.
So maybe we shouldn't be too surprised that we're also seeing cocaine in our environment like we see some of the other pharmaceuticals as well.
This is the largest in a series of lake studies done in Minnesota. Mark Ferre says the test of 50 lakes is large enough to reflect the condition of all Minnesota lakes.
These studies, probably for the first time, are giving us the data that we can statistically extrapolate to say, well, this is the condition of the lakes in our state.
The study identifies an expanding list of chemicals in the water, but it doesn't answer the question of how the chemicals get into the lakes. Sewage treatment plants and septic systems are often a source of pharmaceuticals and other chemicals, but chemicals were found even in remote lakes with no roads nearby. Scientists suspect some chemicals, like cocaine, are in the air and settle into the lakes. Some chemicals might be falling with the rain. Ferre says it's an area that needs more research. All of these chemicals are found at very low levels, often a few parts per trillion. What's a part per trillion? Well, think of a football field-sized swimming pool, four stories deep. Add one drop of water. That's one part per trillion.
The concentrations that we're seeing at part per trillion level are vanishingly small, but there are more and more pieces of the puzzle coming together to show that, yes, they can affect organisms in our environment in ways that are very unsettling.
Ferre points to recent research in Minnesota that found low levels of contamination cause behavioral changes in baby fish that make them less likely to survive. And studies in mice found genetic damage for four generations after pregnant mice were exposed to bisphenol A, the plastics chemical. Mark Ferre says the research on trace amounts of chemicals and pharmaceuticals is still very early. He says 60,000 to 80,000 chemicals are in use, but only 91 are regulated by the Federal Clean Water Act. Ferre says there's a parallel to the 1970s, when scientists began to understand the damage from industrial pollution.
The emphasis in the 70s was, well, here's this pipe spewing out waste into our river, and we've got to put a stop to it. And we did. I think now what we need to do a little bit is to look in the mirror. Now, what are the products that I use, and what are the products going into the waste stream that end up in our surface water?
Ferre says the MPCA plans to continue testing lakes and streams to see if the level of chemicals increases or decreases over time. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
On the topic of chemicals in the water, the Minnesota Health Department will share new results of a study of perfluorinated chemicals, or PFCs, in the blood of East Metro residents. They'll be holding a public meeting later this week. Researchers have concluded some long-term residents of Cottage Grove, Lake Elmo, and Oakdale were exposed to PFCs in unfiltered drinking water. Health Department Coordinator Jessica Nelson says other factors, such as eating a lot of meat or fast food or using various consumer products, were not linked to higher PFC blood levels.
Their exposure was really dominated by their drinking water, and so these other sources of exposure were probably smaller in comparison, so it was hard for us to see them in this group of people if those relationships do exist.
3M made PFCs in the area until 2002, and the chemicals leached from landfills into the groundwater. Blood levels have been declining since residents installed filters in their homes. The meeting is set for Wednesday evening at the Skyview School in Oakdale. The city of St. Paul is looking for new ways to increase the number of people with disabilities who get jobs on city contracts. Its goal is for 10% of those jobs to go to people with disabilities. But as Curtis Gilbert reports, while the effort is new, the goal is not. It was first set in 2006, and since then, the city has not come close to reaching it.
Until last year, St. Paul had no idea how far it had fallen short of its goal because it didn't collect data on how many people with disabilities worked for its contractors. In 2012, it finally asked, and the answer came back, not very many. The contractors said less than 1% of their employees identified themselves as disabled. That's nowhere near the city's 10% goal. Carol Rydell is frustrated with the lack of progress. As a project manager at the nonprofit social service organization Kaposia, she's been trying to help people with disabilities get jobs on St. Paul City projects for the last decade.
I'm not sure that we've actually accomplished anything in 10 years.
Wow, that's sort of depressing.
It is depressing.
In St. Paul's defense, many cities don't set any target for hiring people with disabilities, but St. Paul's goal is just that, a goal. Unlike its affirmative action programs for women and minorities, the goal for hiring employees with disabilities is strictly voluntary. There are no consequences for contractors who fail to meet it, which would be almost all of them. Out of more than 250 city contractors, only 9 of them met the disability hiring goal last year.
It's difficult to say whether or not the contractors are really trying.
Jesse Kingston was hired last year to direct St. Paul's Office of Human Rights and Equal Economic Opportunity.
Perhaps historically we haven't been putting as much emphasis on ensuring that they are making strides in hiring people with disability. And so now we're really changing that focus.
The city is forming a committee to study the issue over the summer and bring back recommendations this fall. NPR News spoke to several city contractors, mostly in construction-related fields. One called the goal unrealistic, and a number questioned whether they would be able to find employees with disabilities capable of doing physically demanding construction work. But for employers who want to hire people with disabilities, the state of Minnesota can help. It's cacophony on the factory floor of GEM Technical in Long Lake as machinists carve precise parts for hydraulic equipment. But Christopher Smith, speaking through a sign language interpreter, doesn't hear any of it.
I'm completely deaf since I was born.
After finishing a program at St. Paul College, Smith spent 3 years looking for a job like this. Then, last summer, he got an email from Vocational Rehabilitation Services. It's a state program that helps people with disabilities train for and find jobs, and it connected him with an internship at GEM. 3 months later, the internship turned into a full-time job.
Oh, I was really excited. I was a lot more excited than I even expected I would be.
Vocational Rehabilitation Services places about 2,500 Minnesotans in jobs every year. But that number is dwarfed by the 8,000 new applications it receives annually from people looking for work. Vocational Rehabilitation's Ron Adams, who helped Smith get the job, says people with disabilities regularly face hiring discrimination.
A lot of employers, they're just not going to give someone a chance that is deaf. I run into that all the time.
Nationally, the unemployment rate for people with disabilities is about 13%, almost twice what it is for the overall population. That's why the Obama administration has proposed instituting disability hiring goals for federal contractors, much like St. Paul did in 2006. The Associated General Contractors of America opposes the proposed rule. It argues expanding affirmative action to include people with disabilities will be costly for employers. Spokesman Brian Termail says those costs will hurt the construction industry, which is already suffering.
The industry went from a $1 trillion industry 5 years ago to an $800 billion a year industry, and that we've lost over 2 million jobs in 5 years. No one's discriminating against these folks. They just, you can't offer jobs that you don't have.
But Carol Rydell, who's critical of St. Paul's failure to meet its hiring goals, sees the proposed federal rule as a reason for optimism. If the Obama administration implements it, she hopes it can bring about a change in the culture.
The more people with disabilities who are employed, the more our view of disability changes, because each person who gets a job affects that employer, the coworkers, customers, vendors. People with disabilities are the best ambassadors in terms of the capabilities of people with disabilities in the workforce.
But Rydell is quick to add, as St. Paul's experience shows, that culture change is still a long way off. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
And that'll do it for the NPR News Update for Monday, May 13th. I'm Matt Sepik. Thanks for downloading.